From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. One of North Carolina's leading political commentators is Professor Andrew Taylor of North Carolina State University. He's a native of Great Britain, and he looks across the pond to assess how controversial Prime Minister Boris Johnson is affecting the chaotic Brexit process. As state lawmakers redraw North Carolina election maps, they're hearing arguments for and against changing the map-making process itself. You'll hear highlights. The anti-monopoly clause in North Carolina's Constitution could play a role in a legal fight over state health care restrictions. Those restrictions make it harder for some North Carolinians to get an MRI. We'll also discuss the implications of declining enrollment numbers in North Carolina's second-largest public school system. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
It is no secret that National Democrats hope to turn North Carolina blue in 2020, including the U.S. Senate seat held by Republican Tom Tillis, who is seeking re-election. But now we've gotten an inside look at the National Democrats' strategy to win that Senate seat, and it came through leaked audio of a Democratic state legislator with firsthand knowledge. Rick Henderson is following the story. Rick, of course, is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. Welcome back.
Thank you, Donna.
Well, this is a very intriguing, and it definitely is election time. State Senator Jeff Jackson, out of the Mecklenburg area,
right,
was part of a class at UNC Charlotte. He made some comments, and now we all know what they were.
Right. He was speaking to a class that Jim Morrill, who's a Charlotte Observer political reporter, a longtime legislative reporter, was teaching at UNC Charlotte. And the class, basically Jeff Jackson was brought in to talk about the political process and the like. And one of the students in the class apparently recorded the lecture and leaked information from the lecture, the audio part of the recording, which basically said that Jeff Jackson says, "I was recruited by the National Democratic Party to potentially be a candidate to run against Tom Tillis in 2020. And Chuck Schumer, who was the lead Democrat in the Senate and heading up the Senate fundraising, was telling me how I was going to run my campaign."
And that's where it gets really, really interesting, because apparently Jeff Jackson went up to D.C. and said to Senator Schumer, "Look, I'm going to go out and campaign. I'm going to talk to constituents. I'm going to do town halls." And the retort, according to Jackson, from Senator Schumer was fascinating.
Yeah, I said no. I don't think so.
Nice
what
talking
we're gonna,
to you.
What we're going to do is we're going to put you, as Jeff Jackson put it, in a windowless basement. You're going to be on the phone all the time raising money, and 80% of your time will be spent raising money on the phone, and we're going to take that money and we're going to use it to run negative ads against Tom Tillis. Now, that's not what Jackson wanted to do at all. As you said, he wanted to go out. He wanted to meet with constituents. He wanted to raise issues. He wanted to pitch the Democratic message around North Carolina, because people may not be familiar with him because he is a state senator from Mecklenburg County. And so his idea was to do, in a way, what Dan Forrest did during his two runs for lieutenant governor, and that is go around the state so that everybody knows who he is. But Schumer said, "No, I don't think so. We're going to have you down here, beating the bushes for money, shaking down people for campaign contributions that we can then convert into television ads and radio ads and mailers and things like that to attack Tillis."
So at that point, apparently Jackson says, "Well, this isn't my kind of thing. I'm not going to do this." But then in the meantime, other Democrats in North Carolina have stepped forward to seek the nomination, and it looks like Cal Cunningham is the person who's getting some sort of big support.
Yeah, and it looks like Cal Cunningham is the guy who said, "Okay, I'll sit in the basement if that's what you want me to do," because he has gotten the endorsement of all of the major national mainstream Democratic organizations. He also is someone who has gotten some negative feedback from some of his Democratic rivals who are saying, "Wait a minute, this guy served a term in the legislature. He's been a perennial candidate, non-winning candidate in a number of races, including some statewide races. It looks like he's the guy that you just put up there because he's going to do whatever you say, Washington Democrats, and not going to represent North Carolina necessarily. And so, Senator Erica Smith from Northampton County has been particularly vocal about that because, of course, the Democratic Party is very aware of issues such as gender and racial diversity, and African-American woman running for a Senate seat against a white male, and all of a sudden the Democrats choice is yet another white male. And so that's caused a lot of tension.
And in fact, Senator Smith was so unhappy with this situation that she actually commented on the record to National Review, which is the publication to which this audio was leaked, apparently by a student who was in that class.
Right, right. So she's not happy about it at all. I don't know how unhappy state Democrats are with this whole situation. I think they want to beat Tom Tillis more than anything else. But it does. It was a fascinating peek behind the curtain as how national campaigns or how national campaigns run in here. I mean, we've run into this a similar sort of storyline with the redistricting lawsuit that the Democratic group led by former Attorney General Eric Holder has filed in North Carolina to challenge the congressional districts. Again, this is people coming in from out of state telling, local Democrats what to do. Representative Robert Reeves is someone who has resisted this. But you see this again, that the groups come in, they say, this is how you're going to run your campaign, or this is what we're going to do. We're going to call the shots. You just, smile and be nice, and we'll tell you how you're going to run your operation.
Well, if anything, Rick, it certainly confirms that the North Carolina Senate seat that Tom Tillis holds right now is critical to Democrats. They want it really, really badly. How important is it to what happens in 2020 with the presidential election and everything that will be going on?
Well, it's really important because there are a handful of Senate seats across the country in which you have an incumbent who's running for reelection who is considered to be vulnerable right now. The Tillis situation is particularly interesting because he's never really had a highly positive net approval rating throughout his tenure in the Senate. I mean, you have some other cases such as Arizona with Martha McSally and the like, where she's someone who was appointed to take an open seat. And so she's actually running for the first time in the 2020 race. But with the Tillis situation, you have someone who was elected in a very contested campaign who came down the stretch and took over from Kay Hagan at the very last minute when he ran that race. And now he is considered to be vulnerable simply because Republicans think it's going to be, a very, very tight race, both nationally and in North Carolina. And his approval numbers have never been as high as an incumbent senator would like.
Rick, should people who are listening to us right now be turned off by this audio and what the National Democratic strategy is? Or really, is this just the way it works and you usually just don't hear about it?
Well, I think that's basically the lesson to take away from it is that, I think they should be upset about the fact that this is how these operations work, that the candidates themselves are not seen as autonomous individuals who are actually working for their constituents, but they're just simply seen as pawns of a national machine. And so that's something people should be upset about. The fact that we did get this actual peek behind the curtain and that we saw how it happened, and we saw a member of the North Carolina General Assembly who was being openly recruited to run for the seat say, no thanks, I don't want to do that. I mean, that's much to, I think, Senator Jackson's credit that he did that. But I think it is something that both should upset people at the fact that that's what the expectation is for candidates running on the national scene, but also it should sort of let people know, that's how it goes.
Well, it does seem that that's how it goes, and the appeal of negative advertising, and that's why we see them all the time, even though a lot of times candidates and parties will say, no, we're not going to do that. We're just
right.
going to try to showcase the differences in what our candidate believes versus
right.
Our opposition. But when it gets down to it, people respond to these negative messages.
Well, they do. They respond to basically discussions of the issues, discussions of positions, and usually the discussions on positions are that other person's position on issue X, Y, and Z is awful.
Right. So she is a bad guy,
yes,
bad woman. Yeah.
Right. And, of course, the candidates themselves, as long as these ads are not run through their campaign fund, The candidates have no control over that message. So it's not as if you need to denounce this commercial. Well, you could say, I don't agree with the message, but you can't do anything about it, because if you attempted to, you would be violating the law yourself.
It is a fascinating story involving North Carolina, making the national publication National Review. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. Rick, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are, and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. He's brash, he's loud, he has a populist streak, he has a wild head of hair, and he's the most important political figure in his country. Donald Trump? No, I'm talking about Boris Johnson of Great Britain. Joining us now with some insights about Johnson is Professor Andrew Taylor, political scientist at North Carolina State University. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Mitch.
Before we get into Boris Johnson, we should point out that what happens in the politics of the United Kingdom, of Great Britain and Northern Ireland is especially important to you, not just as a political scientist, but this is home.
Yes, that's where I'm from originally, and still keep up with British politics quite a lot. I like to read about it, write about it, talk about it, and follow it pretty closely.
And you were recently in Britain and had a firsthand look at how things were going there. What were people talking about politically?
Yeah, so I was just over, doing a little bit of work, a little bit of vacationing, seeing family and what have you. And everybody was talking about Brexit. I mean, just it completely dominates all kinds of conversation about things political. People don't like talking about it because they are, to be honest with you, they're up to there with it because it's just dominated public discourse. But when you nudge them and push them to talk about politics, they'll talk about that. Even more so than the sort of conservative leadership race that you were alluding to, and now the new Prime Minister Boris Johnson. That leadership race has been going on really all summer since former Prime Minister Theresa May said she was going to step down. But even with that going on, which you would think would interest people, it's been Brexit, Brexit, Brexit.
And the two are tied together. Boris Johnson is prime minister largely because of what's happened with Brexit.
Yes. So Johnson has a long sort of backstory, but his sort of recent propulsion to the top of the tree, so to speak, has been based upon his very loud and strong support of the Leave campaign during the referendum in 2016. So he was one of the most prominent conservatives who was saying we need to get out. That, of course, happened. The vote was to leave in June of 2016. Johnson was then appointed as foreign secretary, actually, by Theresa May, who came in as prime minister after the referendum. But he had a big falling out with her, said she was going nowhere with her effort to get in a negotiated departure from the EU with this deal that she got with the European Union. And then, of course, couldn't get through the House of Commons. She tried three times. She failed. That led to her resignation. Johnson, very popular with the Conservative Party grassroots, has now become the leader of the Conservative Party. And since the Conservative Party is the governing party at the moment, albeit in a coalition in British Parliament, he's a prime minister.
We've heard him described by some people as sort of a British Trump, and not just because of the crazy hair and the other things about
including
the populist,
you, by the way,
the populist streak. Is that a fair characterization, or is he a very different sort of fellow?
Yeah, I think it's half and half. Like anything, you know, it's not a he's not a perfect facsimile, but there are some clear commonalities, not just the appearance, as you said, but the sort of populist streak, his sort of reputation as a disruptor. These are things that he has in common with Trump. In terms of sort of policy, and I think this has more to do with where the British Conservative Party is compared to the US Republican Party, he's much more social, much more liberal on social policy than Trump, and that really anybody in the sort of leadership of the Republican Party is. There are some significant differences, but you mentioned the commonalities in there as well. And this sort of Brexit populism took place at the same time, of course, that Trump was being nominated by the Republican Party and then became president of the United States.
We are chatting with Professor Andrew Taylor of NC State University. Sticking with the theme of Boris Johnson and what he believes, you mentioned the more socially liberal than you would expect among a Republican. How about in terms of taxes, trade, economics, where does he stand?
He very much would be there as a conventional Republican in 2019 in the U.S. So one of the things that sort of propels this idea of Brexit is that the EU, not only is the EU sort of controlling its member countries from Brussels, you know, so there's this argument about sovereignty and democracy, but it just piles on regulation after regulation. It spends money frivolously. It doesn't tax, but it causes member nations to have to hike up their revenues in order to be able to pay all of these subsidies. And so one of the major reasons of getting out of the European Union is so that Britain can be a kind of low tax, low regulation, sovereign, autonomous entity. And, you know, that I think it's those kinds of issues that make Johnson appealing to many American conservatives and Republicans.
Does he see himself as a sort of a Churchillian figure?
He does like to do that. And in fact, some of the sort of wackiness and craziness and some of the strange things related to his personal life, which has been pretty tumultuous. He ran London for 8 years, right? Which is a pretty considerable feat. I know it's not helping Bill de Blasio very much in the Democratic nomination contest at the moment as being the mayor of the country's largest city for now in his second term, but it certainly is an important part of a politician's resume, something like that. And he was an MP as well and a cabinet minister. So there's much more substance, political substance. Johnson universally thought of as very smart. But there's much more to him than that. He has real political experience as well.
From your vantage point, how will someone like Boris Johnson tackle this Brexit issue, which is so important right now?
Well, you know, obviously his opponents are saying, oh my gosh, he's driving us off a cliff. There's clearly going to be a no deal Brexit. The economy is going to go into deep recession. It's going to be a complete disaster. But one of the things that people think that Johnson might help Johnson in this situation, even though he has said, you know, I'm kind of willing to live with a no deal Brexit, is his inconsistency and his unpredictability. This is something that's kind of Trumpian as well, that he likes to make deals in ways that seem inconsistent with positions he's taken in the past or with relationships that he has with people. He'll make deals with supposed adversaries. And so he might bring that to these Brexit negotiations with the European Union and perhaps be able to kind of pull out a Hail Mary pass and get some kind of great deal for the UK while the UK gets out of the European Union. That's what some people think may happen. There is something to his unpredictability that gives some people hope that who want to get out, but want to get out with a deal, that he might be able to pull it off.
My guess is whatever happens,
Boris Johnson is probably going to be the most interesting prime minister that Britain has had in years?
Oh, yes. Much, it's hard, with all due respect to Prime Minister May, it's hard to be less colourful than she was. She was known as the robot. And he is certainly different in that way, for better or for worse.
Well, as these events unfold, we know that one person who will be watching very closely is our guest, Professor Andrew Taylor at NC State University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Mitch.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. As North Carolina lawmakers dealt with a court order to redraw their election maps, they also heard arguments for and against changing the map drawing process. Tomas Lopez of Democracy North Carolina wants a new process.
The openness of this process is, in fact, a marked improvement from what we've seen before. That doesn't mean the substance of what is produced is where we need to be. What we've seen are baseline maps that are being used for a purpose for which they were not originally meant to be used. Incumbency prioritized over other priorities, including compactness. And also just the fact that I think, as one of the speakers raised earlier, we have a process that's really difficult to understand. And I want to appreciate that y'all have had a short amount of time to act on this. But despite that, what we've seen in miniature over the last week and a half or so is one of the best arguments for a redistricting process that is fundamentally different than the one we have now. Independent redistricting that doesn't involve lawmakers walking up to the computers and skewing the lines, is something that exists not only in places like California, but in neighboring Arizona, where a United States Supreme Court case upheld an independent redistricting commission only 4 years ago in 2015. And so I would urge all the legislators here to embrace a conversation about independent redistricting after we're done with this work with the maps.
On the other side, Jay DeLancey of the Voter Integrity Project urged Republican legislative leaders not to fall for arguments favoring an independent redistricting commission.
We like honest elections, and I want to congratulate you. Every one of you in this room worked your tails off here, subject to judicial gerrymandering because they didn't like the legislature doing their job. And I congratulate you on getting it done in a transparent way and working so hard the last week to do it. So I wanted to just tell you that I know reading the governor's tweets, we know where he's headed. We know what this agenda for these people is. They want something called a nonpartisan commission to take over the process. I'm sorry, I don't believe in unicorns. I don't believe in the Easter Bunny, and I don't believe in nonpartisan anything. I think we've seen that in judges, and we've seen that in California, where the nonpartisan commission got manipulated through things like, oh, jobs that maybe your niece lost if you didn't go a certain way. These disinterested commissioners who were not accountable, they are under a great deal of pressure, and they're not accountable to the public. Whatever you do, please, fine. There are people in this room who want to have nonpartisan rules. Well, great, as long as everyone follows the rules and don't go to court to try and change them like some people do. But work on the same rules, kind of like you did in 2010, those same rules, where you won the majority for the first time in 100 years. So maybe instead of changing the rules, we just follow the rules.
That was Jay DeLancey of the Voter Integrity Project. Both he and Tomas Lopez spoke at a recent public hearing related to North Carolina's legislative redistricting. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week and listen to Headlock too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock. Just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. A particularly old piece of the North Carolina Constitution could prove helpful as reformers fight against overly burdensome occupational licensing. The group Classical Liberals in the Carolinas heard that message recently from John Guzet. He's director of legal studies at the John Locke Foundation. Guzet is talking about Article 1, Section 34 of the state constitution, also known as the Anti-Monopoly Clause.
This was originally added to our state constitution for the specific purpose of preventing the state from granting special privilege, trade privileges to favored groups. And I'm also going to argue that properly construed, it could still serve that effect, that purpose today.
Guzet says anti-monopoly provisions have been part of the law for hundreds of years. He cites a famous English legal scholar.
Sir Edward Coke is the man to look at because he was the primary source of information about English law and English legal history for all the people in the colonies at the time. And they didn't just regard Coke as an authority. He was a hero to the colonists because they saw in him, even more than John Locke, I would say, he inspired them to, made them think they had rights and they inspired them to defend those rights. So let's look at what the colonists would have learned from reading Coke. One thing they would have learned is what the word monopoly meant in the legal context at the time. And what it meant was not just any kind of monopoly, but a monopoly specifically created by the sovereign. The other thing they would have learned was that that kind of monopoly was illegal under both common law and under statutory law. They would have learned about the former by reading Cook's report of a famous case, Darcy v. Allen, which was published in the colonies under the title The Case of Monopolies. According to the report, the plaintiff, Edward Darcy, who was a groom of the chamber of Queen Elizabeth, had purchased a royal patent granting him an exclusive right to manufacture, import, and sell playing cards. Darcy accused a haberdasher named Thomas Allen of violating that monopoly and sought damages for loss of income. After hearing for arguments for both sides, the Court of King's Bench held that the Queen's grant to Darcy was void because it was a monopoly and therefore against common law.
Gouzet says that court ruling offered more helpful details.
In addition to simply declaring that the patent was void, the court also provided an explanation for why state granted monopolies were against common law. And it's really their analysis could that the court's analysis could hardly be improved upon today. In today's language, we would say that what the court found was that despite what the holders of such monopolies invariably claim, government-conferred monopolies do not benefit society as a whole. Instead, they enrich the monopolists themselves. They harm potential competitors and violate their rights, and they force consumers to pay higher prices for inferior goods and services.
But that ruling didn't end the debate over monopolies. Gouzet turns to the next piece of English legal history.
Elizabeth's successor, James I, ignored it completely. And in response, Cook, who was by that time a member of Parliament and chairman of the Committee of Grievances, led a successful campaign to impose a statutory remedy in the form of the Statute of Monopolies, which declared monopolies are altogether contrary to the laws of this realm. Cook described the statute and its contents in his Institutes of the Laws of England, a multi-volume treatise that was widely read in the colonies and was really until Blackstone was published around the time of the American Revolution, the primary source of English law.
The fight against monopolies doesn't end there either. Gouzet says American colonists also had to deal with government-granted monopolies.
There were more and more monopolies on the international trade or the colonial trade. There were black markets in response to that. England cracked down on those black markets, and we just had escalation of hostilities, which culminated in this event, the Boston Tea Party in 1773, and that would have been fresh in the minds of the members of the Fifth Provincial Congress when they were convening to draw up North Carolina's Constitution in 1776. Given this intellectual and political context, I don't think there can be much doubt that the members of the Fifth Provincial Congress had government-granted monopolies specifically in mind when they drew up the Constitution. By declaring that such monopolies ought not to be allowed, they meant to secure for themselves and their posterity the same right that Darcy v. Allen, the Statute of Monopolies and the Glorious Revolution, had secured for their cousins back in England, namely the right to earn an honest living by engaging in a lawful occupation.
Beyond the history lesson, Gouzet is looking at the impact of the Anti-Monopoly Clause today.
Does the Anti-Monopoly Clause still mean today what it meant in 1776? Does it still forbid government-granted monopolies? Perhaps surprisingly, the answer is yes. And if that's surprising, it's only because the word monopoly has changed. The meaning of the word monopoly has changed quite a bit since colonial times. And it's changed because of the rise of the great trust in the late 19th century. Perhaps by design or perhaps intentionally, the word monopoly was expanded at that time to include not just state-granted monopolies, but also large companies that had, by acquiring their competitors or driving them out of business, succeeded in coming to dominate some market.
So what is the impact of the changing definition of monopoly?
Given that change, you could argue that nowadays the Anti-Monopoly Clause should apply to these kinds of new large corporations that dominate the market. But what you couldn't argue was that it should no longer apply to state-granted monopolies. And one of the reasons you can't say that is because every dictionary I've looked at, and I've looked at a lot that's been published since the late 19th century, includes some version of this language. They always still include as one of the standard definitions of monopoly, a monopoly granted by the sovereign. So it would be strange indeed for a court to conclude that the voters who ratified North Carolina's more recent constitutions intended to narrow the scope of the Anti-Monopoly Clause in a way that excluded both a conventional meaning of the word monopoly and frustrated the purpose for which the clause was originally adopted. And in fact, no court has done that.
Gouzet says a North Carolina court actually offered a very good ruling in the first half of the 20th century.
It dealt with a law that was passed in 1937 under which
It was a crime to engage in the business of dry cleaning, dyeing, and or pressing without first having secured a license or certificate. In 1939, an unlicensed dry cleaner challenged the law, and in 1940, in a forceful opinion by Justice Sewell, the North Carolina Supreme Court struck it down. Sewell specifically affirmed the original understanding of the anti-monopoly clause. He insisted that that understanding was still valid. And on that basis, he struck the law down.
Gouzet recaps the history, going back more than 400 years.
In 1603, England's highest court held that monopolies are against the common law. In 1624, Parliament enacted a statute of monopolies which stated that monopolies are altogether contrary to the laws of this realm. In 1776, North Carolina's first constitution declared that monopolies ought not to be allowed. And in 1971, North Carolinians ratified the current constitution, which declares even more emphatically that monopolies shall not be allowed. None of that has deterred North Carolina state government from granting legal monopolies. And while these have taken many forms, the vast majority have taken the form of occupational licensing laws. These have proliferated at a rate that would have made the Tudor and Stuart monarchs blush.
Final thoughts from a famous legal scholar?
I'm going to give Cook the last word, and he got it exactly right. The fight against government-granted monopolies will never end. The potential rewards are too big, and special interest groups and legislators will never stop trying to divide those rewards between them. Those who wish to exercise the right to earn an honest living will just have to keep fighting. But I hope I've convinced you that one of the weapons they can use in that fight is North Carolina's anti-monopoly clause.
That's John Gouzet, Director of Legal Studies at the John Locke Foundation. He's discussing the North Carolina Constitution's anti-monopoly clause. Gouzet delivered these remarks recently in Winston-Salem to the group Classical Liberals in the Carolinas. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. North Carolina, no secret, is one of the fastest growing states in our country, thanks to our beautiful natural wonders and, of course, our thriving economy. And as more and more families move into the state, one might presume that there will be pressure on public schools to be ready for this influx of new kids. But new school enrollment data is now casting doubt on that very premise. Dr. Terry Stoops is the Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. He's been writing about these enrollment trends at johnlocke.org. Terry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Give us the update on enrollment in the two largest public school systems in the state, Wake and Mecklenburg.
Well, Mecklenburg released their 20-day numbers, and it indicated that compared to last year, they were down around 465 kids. And that's a... For the size of the system that has about 147,000 kids, on a percentage basis, it's not a whole lot. But it's notable because this is a system that's been adding a significant number of students over the last few years. I looked at the trends between 2005 and 2015, and the district added about over 27,000 kids to its rolls. So this is a real reversal here in Charlotte-Mecklenburg to see a drop of this size. Last year in Charlotte-Mecklenburg, the enrollment was about the same. I think they lost like 7 kids or something to that effect. So it wasn't a significant decline last year, but this year it indicates that there will be a significant decline. Now, I should mention that 20-day numbers can be misleading. in these first few weeks of school, parents are moving in and out of schools. They're moving to charter schools, private schools. They decide to homeschool. So there's a lot of movement. So we're not going to hear the last of it just because we have the 20-day numbers in Charlotte-Mecklenburg. We'll probably hear the most about it when we get those 40-day numbers, which are key numbers for the state to determine funding.
Mecklenburg is the second largest public school system in the state. Wake County is the largest. And you have written a number of pieces about what's happening in the Wake system. Tell us about that.
Well, last year, Wake County lost 42 kids. They were down 42 compared to the year before. We don't have 20-day numbers for Wake because they simply haven't released them. They don't have to release them. This was something that Charlotte-Mecklenburg does, but Wake doesn't. So we're waiting to see what the 40-day numbers look like in Wake County. We suspect that there's going to be a slight decline in Wake County, which again is also very surprising because, like Charlotte-Mecklenburg, it has been a district that has seen immense growth. Now, one little catch to all this is that at the beginning of the school year, there was a report in the Durham Herald Sun that indicated that the Durham County schools had an increase of kids this year, an unexpected increase of kids this year compared to the year before. So I don't know what that means for Wake County. I don't know if Durham's what they're experiencing there is going to mean the same for Wake County or whether Wake County is going to have a different experience in Durham. I mean, Durham was caught off guard with this increase, and even Durham County officials weren't quite sure why there were more students than they anticipated.
So we've got Charlotte-Mecklenburg with these 20-day numbers. They've been down now for 2 years. That's kind of the trend that we're seeing there, knowing it could change. Yeah. Then in Durham County, we're seeing a bit of an uptick. And in Wake County, that 42, was that 42 additional students, or did they lose 42 in those numbers that you were
they
talking
lost
about?
42 students. Okay. And that was quite a shock, I think, to everyone, considering that the Wake County school demographers predicted that there would be hundreds, if not thousands, of additional students attending the schools that year. So that was a real surprise when those numbers came out and were reported on by the News and Observer.
Any idea what is factoring into this? Is it a trend? Are we seeing it in other places in the state? Or is it just happenstance?
Well, we're seeing a combination of factors that are playing a role here. Declining birth rates are playing a role. We know that for some time there were those who were predicting that there would be a decrease in overall public school enrollment across the nation, and that we would start seeing that trickle into North Carolina. Now we were able to insulate ourselves from that because we have general population growth in the state. Many other states have been losing students for a very long time. So now it's just catching up to North Carolina. But birth rates are having a factor. Even though we have an increased population in our urban centers, a lot of that increase is not families. It's either retirees or those without children. So that's playing a role. But school choice, without a doubt, is also playing a role.
Tell us more about that, because we know that this state is one of the leaders in school choice. We know that we have a absolutely booming homeschool movement, as well as people opting for virtual charters, brick and mortar charters, private schools, etc. So what does that play into these this whole number scenario?
Well, to give you an example of Wake County last year, which the district lost 42 kids, the charter schools gained around 1,500. So we do see parents exercising choice. Wake County, of course, has a tremendous homeschool population, the largest in the state, largest private school population. So we're seeing parents more often than not starting to opt for these choices that are provided them. And the choices are more ample than ever. I mean, if you look at Wake County, this year they have 24 charter schools. In Mecklenburg County, they have 31 charter schools, and that doesn't include the fact that there are students in those counties that attend charter schools outside of the county, which you can do with charters. You don't have to be in the county to attend a charter school in that county. So we have students that are hopping the border to attend charter schools. Homeschooling is as popular than ever in North Carolina, with around 145,000 homeschool students across the state. And then we have private schools, which aren't growing as fast, but I think due in part to the Opportunity Scholarship, the vouchers that are available to children and their families, and the special needs savings account that also they have available, we're going to see a continued uptick in the number of private school students due to those programs.
Terry, what is it that parents and kids are finding in these other options that they're not finding in a traditional public school classroom?
Well, it varies by the family. And this is the important point, is that no two families choose an alternative based on the same criteria. Sometimes I know that parents in Wake County feel it's kind of daunting to have their kid in a system that has 160,000 children. There are school size issues. There are school safety issues. Academic rigor plays a role. Sometimes the values of the family are not consistent with the values of the school system. We saw recently that at Heritage High School in Wake County, there was a questionnaire given out to students that many parents thought was inappropriate. It's those sorts of things that parents look at, the kind of things that are being offered at their school, and prompts them to consider alternatives. And we should, as much as possible, provide those alternatives for parents based on whatever criteria they use to select their school.
We've been talking with Dr. Terry Stoops. He is the Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation, talking about what are some numbers here about enrollment in at least two or three of the major public school systems in North Carolina that are giving people pause. You can read all of Terry's work at johnlocke.org and carolinajournal.com. Terry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.